This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello. You probably heard this show. It's called Night Transmissions. Me, I'm called Gary Clinton, and this is the 105th Night Transmissions. I got something new. Well, something new to us. It's old in the world. It's an episode of The Whistler called The Murder Arrangement. The Whistler was an extraordinarily successful radio show broadcast for the first time on May the 16th of 1942 on CBS. Its beginning wasn't really all that auspicious. It was originally a regional show limited to distribution on the West Coast. And this happens sometimes when the sponsor, in this case, Signal Oil, was only available in a particular region of the country. In this case, Signal Oil, as you might suspect, was available only in the western part of the United States. Although, it would not really be long before CBS would find a national sponsor and go nationwide with the program. The program would ultimately have a run of 13 years. The show revolves around the Whistler, who each week entertains us with a murder story. On most occasions, the Whistler was played by Bill Foreman, although on occasion another actor would take over the role. Among those who took the part of the Whistler were some actors that we are still familiar with. Marvin Miller played the part, as did Bill Johnston and Everett Clark. There was also a large repertory company. Joseph Kearns, Betty Lou Gerson, Hans Conried, Lorene Tuttle, Gloria Vondel, John McIntyre, Jeanette Nolan, Frank Lovejoy, Jeff Chandler, just a mess of them. Mercedes McCambridge. Another familiar name is Wilbur Hatch. Now, Wilbur Hatch was responsible for the mood music and composed the theme music, which is that iconic whistle, which was actually done by a woman named Dorothy Roberts. There are exactly 37 notes in the show. There are 13 at the beginning, and there are 11 that lead into the story, and then at the end is another 13. The episode for today, it's a nice mixture about people who are keeping, well, you know, kind of low company. There's an attempted murder or two, assorted double dealings, a couple of frame-up jobs, and, I'm sorry to say, betrayal. In other words, it wasn't just another day for Larry Sims. Larry knew he was going to have a bad night in a few days when somebody tried to kill him. In the middle of the night, as he was attempting to fix a flat tire, run right over him. So, from February the 25th of 1951,
I am the Whistler. And I know many things, for I walk by night. I know many strange tales hidden in the hearts of men and women who have stepped into the shadows. Yes, I know the nameless terrors of which they dare not speak.
And now, the Whistler's strange story. Murder Arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
The darkness of the deserted road was exaggerated by the shroud of trees lining either side. Larry Sims, bending over, trying to fix the tire on his car, felt very much alone, and he worked clumsily, impatiently. He straightened up at the sound of another car approaching very fast. Suddenly, the other car swerved in toward him. He leaped back just in time. It almost struck him down as its fender scraped his. Larry sprang forward again as the speeding vehicle rushed on. He tried to catch a glimpse of the driver, the number on the license plates. But the car, its lights off, was quickly swallowed up in the night. And all that Larry knew for certain was that someone had followed him, deliberately tried to kill him. He was still shaking nervously as he drove back to town. Even the friendly lights on the outskirts failed to cheer or calm his fears. He drove directly to an apartment, left his car in the alley, hurried upstairs. He had to ring the door buzzer several times before the door opened.
I've got to see you, Mildred.
Well, Larry, isn't this rather an odd hour?
Let me in, Mildred, quickly. I've got to talk to you.
Well, certainly, come in.
You've never seen Larry so upset, have you, Mildred? His face is drained of color. His eyes, wild with fear, are blinking nervously as he quickly surveys the room, as if he expected someone else to be there, someone he fears. Apparently satisfied that you're alone, he turns to you suddenly.
Mildred, he's out of prison, isn't he? Fred Belton, I mean.
Out? Well, yes, why?
I knew it. I figured he'd get that parole.
You'd better have a drink, Larry. You're actually shaking.
Fred tried to kill me, tried to run me down tonight on a lonely road.
What? Oh, you do need a drink. I'll fix it. Sit down.
I was trying to fix a tire. He came at me out of the darkness, driving fast.
You've been listening to too many mystery programs, darling. There are much neater ways to kill people now. Neater and cleaner. Here's your drink.
Mildred, you've got to believe me. Have you seen Fred? Talk to him.
Yes. As a matter of fact, I drove up to state prison this morning and met him. Drove him back to the city.
And you didn't call me? Mildred, you know I've been worried about him, trying to avoid him.
Well, Larry, I do believe you're afraid of Fred.
It's putting it mildly. Mildred, what am I going to do? You know he thinks I framed him, double-crossed him. Did he mention anything? Ask about me?
No.
Mildred, you're keeping something from me. He's made you promise not to warn me. He just wants to walk in on
me. Larry, your drink is getting warm. And so are you. Look, if you're so concerned about Fred, why not hide out for a few days?
I've got to do something. I can't just sit around, wait to run into him.
Guilty conscience, Larry?
Mildred, you know I didn't have anything to do with framing Fred. I wasn't even around when Fred got picked up. I was at the cabin, at the Crestline.
Well, then, you've got nothing to worry about.
Mildred, please, help me think of some place to hide.
Well, if you're that worried, I suppose he has had too much time on his hands in prison. I mean, too much time to think. Say, I know Larry.
What?
Joan's apartment. She's out of town for a week. She left a key with me. Fred doesn't even know Joan.
Wonderful. I'll go there right now, tonight. You can get in touch with me when you know something, huh?
No, you know best. I'll get you the key.
If you hear anything, that is, if I'm wrong about Fred, you'll let me know.
You know I will. I'll talk to him tomorrow. Aren't you going to kiss me goodnight?
You bet I am. You're okay, Mildred. You understand. I had to have somebody to talk to tonight. A thing like
it's
this.
It's all right. And maybe you're right. At least you'll feel safer at Jones. And Larry, the next drink I fix for you.
Yeah.
You'll be able to stay and finish it. Good night, Larry. I'm only telling you...
Mildred, you know I'm not after Larry.
Well, he seems to think you are. That's why I sent for you this morning, to tell you to stay away from him. You don't deny you'd like to talk with him.
No, I don't. I told you that yesterday. Not to kill him, Mildred. Larry wouldn't have the guts to frame anybody, least of all me. But he just might have an idea who did.
I doubt that.
I mean, he might have some information that I could fit in somewhere. Maybe even something he doesn't realize, something that would give me the whole story.
And when you know the whole story?
Well, I told you that too, sweetheart. But I'll elaborate. Now, there's three things I want out of life now. One, there's a chance for a decent break. Two, the guy that sent me up.
And three?
You, Mildred.
You didn't lose your technique in prison, did you?
Just made the appetite sharper, that's all.
From your punctuality this morning, I'd say it also sharpened your attention to schedule.
Yeah, it did. You know, I don't mind that part, the routine, everything on the dot. It's okay with me.
Oh, Fred, why don't you stop worrying about who framed you and why? There are other things to think about.
I know. But I'll get to them, baby. On schedule. In the proper time and place.
Hmm? You know best. And you won't stay away from Larry.
Nope. Might as well tell me where to find him.
So you can talk.
That's all, I promise. He's not the guy I'm after.
I'm sorry, Fred. I think too much of you to let you get into trouble. When you're on parole, you've got to watch your step.
Okay, but I'll find him myself. You do believe it, Dora, don't you? I had nothing to do with trying to run him down the car last night.
I'll try to believe it. I want to. Because, well, you know.
Sure, I know. Come here, Amanda.
You'd better go now.
Okay. Like you said, parolees have to watch their behavior, huh?
Something like that.
See you soon?
Of course. Good night, Fred. Hello?
Mildred Carson, please.
Speaking?
Oh, Miss Carson, this is Jennings. You know, you drive car rentals?
Yes.
Hey, about that car you rented from us last night.
What about it?
Well, the right fender was badly scraped. You know, you should have reported that to me. You see, there's a charge for anything like that.
Oh, yes, of course. Well, just send me the bill.
Oh, well, how'd it happen, Miss Carson?
Well, I really don't know. It must have been while it was parked somewhere. I really didn't have anything to do with it.
Well, it's okay to send the bill to you then, huh?
That's right. I'll be glad to settle it. It will be a pleasure. Good night, Mr. Jennings.
Mildred, you missed out, didn't you? In your desperate attempt to run Larry Sims down in that rented automobile. The only fortunate thing about it is that he didn't catch a glimpse of you driving when he leaped back just in time. But you still have Fred Belton to deal with. Stubborn, orderly-minded Fred, who won't rest until he talks to Larry. Tries to learn from him who was responsible for his arrest a few years ago. You know what'll happen if the two meet, don't you? Larry will say something you're certain that Fred can add to the facts he now holds. It will add up to one terrible thing, won't it? That it was you, Fred's supposed sweetheart, who tipped off the police and brought about his arrest. You must keep Larry out of sight, Mildred. Keep Fred from locating him, talking to him. But it can't go on indefinitely. So there's something else you must do. Yes, you've got to try again. And next time, you know you can't afford to miss. You're pacing the floor of your apartment, wondering what to do and how and when, as you hear a knock on the door. Nervously open it, and sigh with relief as you realize it's Macaulay, the parole officer assigned a check on Fred Belton.
Oh, Lieutenant Macaulay, come in.
Well, thanks, Miss Carson. I haven't time. Just a word right here, if you don't mind. A word about Fred Belton.
Yes, what about... He isn't in trouble.
No, not yet. I'd like to keep it that way as much as you would.
Oh, well, he's just a friend.
Yeah, I know. You said that the other day when you asked about meeting him upstate. Fred's landlady said differently. She said you liked the guy.
Nosy, isn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Well, all right, so I like Fred Belton. He's pretty.
And you want to keep him out of trouble.
And I want to keep him out of trouble. So what's going on?
Well, we got a call at headquarters, a call from Larry Sims. Know him?
Yes.
Well, Larry Sims is a worried gent. Thinks Fred tried to kill him the other night. Thinks it isn't safe for him to come back to town.
So?
So, what do you think?
So I think Fred isn't that foolish. I understand he isn't even carrying a gun.
Maybe not. But Fred Belton's got a bad temper, Miss Carson. Just a friendly suggestion. Keep him away from Larry, huh?
I'll try.
You could keep him away from anybody.
Then I'll really try.
Good.
That's all?
That's all.
Well, nice to meet you, officer. A cop who's really interested in giving a guy a break.
There's a lot of us like that. You know that.
Yeah, maybe I do. All right. Thanks, anyway. For Fred.
You watch Lieutenant McCauley walk down the corridor out of sight. He's given you an idea, hasn't he, Mildred? Yes, an excellent idea. The solution to your problem. Because if Larry Sims turns up dead soon, the first suspect will be Fred Belton. But you'll need one thing, won't you, Mildred? Proof. You've got to have something that will tie Larry's death to Fred without question. And something that you said, your own words coming back in your mind, provide the answer to that one.
I understand he isn't even carrying a gun.
That will do it, won't it, Mildred? He isn't supposed to be carrying a gun. No. But you're sure you can arrange that. Just as you're sure you can arrange Larry Sims' murder. You determine to start the arranging at once. The first step, an evening visit to Fred Belton's landlady.
Yes, what is it? Oh, Miss Carson.
Good evening, Mrs. Elkins.
Do come in, my dear.
Well, I only stopped by for a minute. I wondered if you'd do me a favor.
Why, of course.
I have a package here, a little gift for Fred. Mr. Belton, I was wondering if you'd let me into his apartment. I'd like to leave it there. It's sort of a surprise.
Of course, of course. I'll give you my keys.
Oh, well, I'd rather you came with me. You see, well, there's something I want to talk with you about.
Oh? Well, all right, Miss Carson. Be with you in a minute.
Hasn't it been a lovely day?
Yes, quite lovely.
Dear me, now, where did I put my key ring? Oh, here it is.
Come along, my dear.
How is your husband, Mrs. Elkins?
Oh, same as usual. Oh, really, now, I must speak to him again about this elevator door. Sticks something terrible. There we are. Now, come along, Miss Carson. There was something you wanted to talk to me about?
Yes, it's about Fred Belton.
Nicest tenant I've had in the building ever, believe me. He was here for years, long before he... well, you know.
Yes.
He's changed a bit, of course. It does that to a man, I suppose, all those years behind bars. But still and all, here we are.
Ms. Elkins, just a minute before you open the door. I had a visitor yesterday, Fred's parole officer.
Tall, well-built man, sandy hair.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I've seen him here several times.
He's worried about Fred.
Oh?
And frankly, so am I. Fred's been acting strangely. There's something on his mind. He seems to be brooding about something. Really, Mrs. Elkins, I am worried.
Oh, now. I don't think Mr. Belton's apt to be doing anything wrong.
I wish I could be sure. Well, thanks anyway for letting me tell you about it.
This way.
Mrs. Elkins, I'd like to ask another favor.
Of course. What is it?
Well, if you could just sort of, I don't know, keep an eye on Fred for me. Let me know if he does anything unusual, the slightest little thing that doesn't seem right.
I'd be glad to tell you, Miss Carson. There's very little goes on in this building that I don't know about. Here we are.
Well, Now that that's off my mind, where will I hide this package? I don't want Fred to find it right away.
Let me see. There's the bookcase over here, or that chair. You could put it behind the pillow.
No, I know. The bedroom. In a drawer somewhere.
Good idea.
Oh, yes. Yes, I think this will be fine.
What is it, my dear?
Why, I thought I heard footsteps in the hall. Do you suppose...
Oh, dear, it wouldn't do to have Fred catch us here. Wouldn't be much of a surprise, would it?
No.
I'll go and see.
You don't waste a minute, do you, Mildred? As soon as she's out of the room, you step quickly to the bureau, open the bottom drawer, and drop the revolver on top of the shirts. You close it again. And you're standing by the window, looking out, when Mrs. Elkins returns.
Not a soul there, my dear.
Oh, well, thank goodness. For a moment, I was certain Fred had caught us red-handed. Well, now, let me see. The bureau seems like a good place to hide the package. Where does Fred keep his shirts, do you know?
Bottom drawer, I think. Yes, here they are. Oh, dear.
What's wrong, Mrs. Elkins?
Look at this.
A gun. What's Fred doing with a gun?
Dear.
Oh, I don't like this. I don't like it at all. The idea of Fred with a gun. Oh, Mrs. Elkins, you mustn't say anything to anyone. I'll talk to Fred myself right away. He's got to get rid of this gun.
You're quite right. It'll only lead to trouble for him, and we certainly don't want that to happen. Maybe you could take it with you.
No. No, I'm afraid that would make him angry. We'd better leave it just where it is. But the next time I see him, I'll talk to him about it. I'll tell him to dispose of it.
I guess that is best.
I'm sure it is. I wonder where he is right now.
I've no idea. He went out late this afternoon.
Oh, then he's probably downtown. Mrs. Elkins, is there a pencil and paper handy? I'd like to leave him a note.
Of course, my dear. There's some over there on Fred's desk. I'll have to run now. Help yourself. And don't forget to lock up when you leave.
No, I won't.
It's working beautifully, isn't it, Mildred? Your little plan. Everything falling neatly into place. And now, with Mrs. Elkins gone, you make the next move. Take the gun out of the drawer and replace it in your purse. Then you drop the gift package into the drawer and close it. You move quickly to the window by the fire escape. Unlock it and open it slightly. Then you leave a note for Fred, asking him to call you. And hurry back to your own apartment to wait. Shortly before 9, your telephone rings.
Yes.
Hello, Millie.
Oh, Fred.
I got your message just now, and the gift. Thanks, but how come?
Oh, it's not much, really. I just wanted to surprise you. I happened to be out shopping, saw the ties, and thought you'd like them.
Well, I do, thanks.
Fred, the reason I asked you to call, I've got to talk to you. It's very important.
Okay, let's have it.
Oh, no, not over the phone. I'll meet you somewhere. The park?
Wait a minute, Mildred. What's up?
I'll explain later. Meet me at the park near the fountain at 10 o'clock. Can you make it?
10 o'clock it is. I'll be there, right on the nose.
You can be certain of that, can't you, Mildred? Yes, Fred's always been very punctual. And you know he'll be there on time, just when you want him to be. Now you're ready for the next step, aren't you? You hurry downstairs to the garage, get into your car, and drive across town to the apartment where Larry Sims is hiding out.
Who is it?
It's Mildred, Larry. Let me in.
What are you doing here, Millie?
I came to warn you.
What?
You better get your hat and coat. Fred is on his way.
Fred, come here? But how did you find out?
I don't know how he found out, but that's not important now. You've got to get out of here. And fast.
I think it's my only chance, Millie.
I'm not so sure
it is. I've got to get out of town, that's all, and keep running.
Where will you go? Remember, it costs money to run and keep running.
Yeah, I know that. Okay. So you got any other ideas?
Yes, I think so.
What are you doing? Why are we stopping?
The park is as good a place as any to talk things over. And we have things to talk over, Larry.
Okay.
All right, come on, let's get out.
Look, why can't we just sit here
and... Come on, Larry. We've got to figure something out for you. I can think much better when I'm walking.
All right. Have it your way.
You know, darling, I really don't have to get mixed up in this. I'm only trying to help you.
Sure, sure, I know, Millie. I'm sorry. You're okay. Strictly okay to do this for me.
Thanks.
Tipping me off about Fred. Saving my life. Millie, I'll never forget you.
No. No, I don't think you ever will. That would be 10 o'clock, wouldn't it, Larry?
Yeah, sure. So what?
So, this.
Hey, what? It's the idea of the gun.
The idea, Larry, darling, is that I'm going to kill you.
Mildred, it went perfectly, didn't it? You're certain of that, aren't you? Yes, every step of the way, just as you'd arranged it. Larry Sims is dead, and you've already put the murder weapon, the gun, back in Fred Belton's apartment, in the bottom bureau drawer where Mrs. Elkins saw it earlier this evening. It was clever of you to leave Fred's window by the fire escape open, wasn't it? No one saw you enter or leave his apartment. Now, back in your own apartment. A little less than 2 hours after you murdered Larry, left him lying in the park, you congratulate yourself, confident that the case against Fred Belton is airtight. Standing there in the open doorway is the lieutenant from police headquarters, Fred Belton's parole officer.
Good evening, Miss Carson.
Well, hello.
May I come in?
Please do. Still worried about Fred?
He's been taken into custody.
What's that?
You remember this Larry Sims I was telling you about the last time I was here?
Why, yes. He was afraid Fred was going to kill him.
Mm-hmm. Sims is dead, Miss Carson. His body was found in the park an hour ago.
Oh, no. No, you don't mean that Fred...
He denies killing Sims, but we found the murder weapon, a .38, in Fred Belton's apartment.
I see.
You had a date with Fred Belton tonight, didn't you?
Well,
he says you did.
Yes, we had a date tonight.
Miss Carson, I've heard Fred Belton's version of what happened tonight. Suppose now you tell me yours.
But I... Well, all right, I guess I may as well tell you everything. I had nothing to do with the killing. Fred called me and asked me to meet him at the park, and I did. I didn't know what Fred was going to do. Then when Larry Sims showed up, there was an argument.
Go on, Miss Kirsten.
Fred had a gun. I tried to stop him, but... Well, he'd have killed me, too. I had to stand by helplessly and watch him kill Larry.
You know, Miss Kirsten, you've just about talked yourself into the gas chamber.
What?
You see, Fred Belton's landlady, Mrs. Elkins, was worried about him. She thought it her duty to tell us that Belton had a gun. Fred's on parole, you know, and a parolee isn't allowed to have a gun in his possession.
Mrs. Elkins told you this?
Yes. She phoned us early this evening. Fred Belton never did get out to the park to keep that date with you, Miss Carson. We had him in custody an hour before the murder. He's been with us at headquarters all evening.
Whistler is entirely fictional. All characters portrayed on the Whistler are also fictional. Any similarity of names or resemblance to persons living or dead is purely coincidental. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Amazing new Biotex acts with a biological action to soak out the stubbornest stains and loosen dirt. New Biotex is great for all textiles and synthetics, whites and colors. It contains no bleach. Get amazing new Biotex today and let soaking do the washing.
Yeah, well, I agree. That one wasn't really that good. The Whistler, as I recall, is generally better than this. I mean, we didn't really know who these people were, what they had done to each other, exactly what their relationships were to each other. So why did I play it? Why didn't I just run away from it? Well, I've said it before. These programs are historical documents. They all tell us something about ourselves, something about the world we lived in 60 years ago. It takes the bad with the good. Now, from the Canadian series Nightfall, this was for a time one of the most popular shows on CBC Radio, running to about 100 episodes, featuring a mix of original tales, an adaptation of both classic and obscure stories. Tonight's story is an adaptation from a Peter S. Beagle story, who is best known for his novel, The Last Unicorn. Like all of the Nightfall series, it's hard to screw down the date on particularly tightly. It is supposedly the 27th episode. The show ran between 1980 and 1983, which would seem to put it firmly in late 1980 or perhaps early 1981. There are a lot of stories based around the notion that death comes to visit. Not too many where death is invited to a party, which the bored aristocrat Lady Neville did in 1750 London. Did I mention that Lady Neville is jaded? And when I say jaded, I don't mean bejeweled. The radio play asks and answers many interesting questions. Just how do you deliver an invitation to death? And what about the RSVP and death himself? What's he going to look like? Is he going to look like Chris Lee? Is he going to look like Peter Cushing? It is London, you know. These and other important questions will be answered in this excellent paper.
In the dream, you are falling, lost in the listening distance, as dark locks in. Nightfall. Good evening. Tonight we would request your attendance at a formal ball given to honor the most important guest of all. The setting is London. The year 1750. The play, based on a short story by Peter S. Beagle and dramatized by Len Peterson, is called The Guest of Honor.
Parties. I'm so bored with parties.
But it's expected, Lady Neville.
That I open the season with a gala that leaves everyone gasping. Lorimond, you're the poet. Inspire me.
Oh, let's see. Poisoned champagne every fifth glass. Milady, you'd be the talk of London and Edinburgh.
Don't be serious, Lorimond. Now, whom might I invite who wouldn't bore me silly?
The king, of course, and the archbishop.
Georgie Porgy, when he goes on and on and on in his German strudel English about his mistresses and his money, my feet go to sleep. As for the Archbishop of Canterbury, all that talk about altar boys. But you have inspired me, Lorimond. Someone I've not thought of.
Oh?
The ultimate guest.
Who?
Death.
You mean...
death? In person.
It would never have occurred to me. Such a stunning idea. Death. A party guest. Why not? At Lady Neville's next grand ball. Since her husband died, her life increasingly has been devoted to parties and balls. The leading lords of England, all eager to be invited. She's the wisest and wittiest woman in all London, Lady Neville. And I, David Lorimond, her personal secretary and poet laureate. What a brilliant combination.
Strike the king off my list, Lorimond.
His Majesty off. As you wish. Struck off.
And his queen.
Caroline.
All that royal Teutonic wit. Boring. Ecclesiastical wit. Off the list as well.
The Archbishop of Canterbury.
All archbishops. And bishops.
It should improve the general level of dancing.
And no George Frederick Handel.
No Handel on the harpsichord? Playing for his supper?
Oh, his music's marvellous, but I doze.
Oh, my dear Flora, this is beyond my comprehension, this break with... Look, ask your wisest friends if this is not rash. Inconceivable.
Summon them!
Thank you for coming, Colonel Compson, Lord and Lady Torrance, Condessa della Cantini. I am to break the news to you.
News?
For her grand ball to open the season, Lady Neville has struck off all eminences except you few. Even the king is off the list.
But Flora loves court gossip.
No more.
But a ball without...
And she has had Handel.
Had Handel?
Had Handel. More and more, my dear friends, I find my parties entertaining everyone but me.
But Flora, darling, the secret of your long life...
Not finding anything dull. Now everything is intolerable. Going to parties to be bored, especially my own.
So you intend...
To my next ball, I shall invite the one guest not even I shall find boring.
Lady Neville, do tell.
The guest of honor shall be Death himself.
Charming.
Death?
Lady Neville, you are jesting.
Death will come when ready. Why hurry him?
Oh, Colonel Compson, if Death has plans to take any one of us on the night of my party, he will come, whether invited or not.
And if he has no such plans?
Then I think it will be diverting to have Death among us. And if he is in a good humor, offering us a trick or two from the beyond.
Lady Neville, Death is so busy, I doubt he'll accept your invitation.
No one has ever refused an invitation of mine.
Well, it'll certainly be the unforgettable event of the season. Death dancing at Lady Neville's ball.
One difficulty, Lady Neville.
Yes, Lorimond.
If sending an invitation... How do we address him?
Ah.
His lordship, dear?
Well, that puts him only on the level of a viscount or a baron.
Yes. His Majesty.
And make him the king's equal?
Well, impossible. Couldn't do that.
His Eminence, dear?
Ah, David. Ah, so clever with words.
Still, how is the invitation to reach Death?
Who knows where he lives?
Well, he must have a good address.
Or does he live among the poor, their only friend?
David Lorimond, Death may be forced to deal with poor people, but I hardly think he seeks them out. Death must be a nobleman.
Well, the question remains, what street and name or number of his residence?
Darrell, my hairdresser, has a sick child. He was telling me just yesterday. It sounded quite despairing. Send for him, Lorimond. We'll give him the invitation. Darrell, in turn, can give it to Death when His Eminence comes to take the brat.
It's a bit unconventional.
I see no other way.
If your hairdresser refuses...
Why should he?
Milady, you don't think it a cruel thing to do?
Lorimond, get on with it. Fetch him.
No fuss. Darrell, the hairdresser, comes as bidden.
Sir, Lady Neville's wanting me?
Yes. Come in.
I'm not to do her hair?
No.
Hair of a guest, then?
Not a guest.
I don't do servants' hair. Three scissors and pins never touch but ladies' dresses. She had to test me, sir. Scheming to give me a scullery maid to dolly up, and when I does, out I goes.
No, Darrell, no.
Something missing. A valuable? I wouldn't touch a valuable.
Ah, Lorimer, you tracked him down. Darrell, How is your son?
Billy? Poorly, ma'am.
Well, when death comes for him, will you please give him this invitation?
Death? Lady Neville?
Well, you are expecting him, aren't you? At home?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, why the surprised look? Take the invitation, give it to him. And it's RSVP. Mind you get a reply.
This is all, ma'am?
Yes, all. But highly important to me.
I'll, see to it, ma'am.
Lorimond, I was right, as usual. He's happy to do it.
Darrow, the hairdresser, back. After only 2 days, with a small white envelope.
Madam, death gave me this.
Oh, nice of you, Darrow. Thank you. Oh. Plain, tasteful calling card. Where are my glasses? Oh, you read it, Lorimond.
Death will be pleased to attend Lady Neville's ball.
Marvellous. Darrow, what's he like?
Like?
Yes. What is death like?
Death?
Lorimond, call Colonel Compson from the sunroom. He must see my little triumph.
Yes, Lady Neville.
Now, Darrow, tell me about his manner, his looks, his dress. Death.
Well, it's hard to...
Oh, why, you are being tedious, Darrow. Ah, Colonel, see what I have. This communication from guess who?
I am surprised. And not surprised. What could Lady Neville not demand and get?
Terse, isn't it?
Indeed.
But a plain card. No crest, no embossing. I find that peculiar.
Not as peculiar as the writing. Almost a delicate hand.
Refined? Cultivated?
There was nothing delicate about the death I saw on the battlefield. Slashing right and left. Black armored. Stride a black horse.
Darrow, how could you be sure it was death?
What did death say?
Are you trying to make fools of us?
My little son.
Lorimond, call the footman.
But my lady...
Take this insolent fellow, give him a sound whipping, and throw him out into the street.
Lady Neville, the poor man lost his son not an hour ago.
And he must learn that I am not to be trifled with. I believe that note is genuine. The ball in death's honor shall take place 2 weeks from tonight. Let death come as death pleases.
But, as a skeleton?
I am less frightened of death and less certain of its form than I was. I am too old to be afraid of anything that can still use a quill pen to write a letter. Colonel Compson, David Lorimond, spread the word to my many friends and urge them to speak to their servants so that all of London may be informed. On this one night, no one in the world will die. For death will be dancing at Lady Neville's ball.
Lady Neville's Evening of Evenings. Everyone arrives early. Handsome carriages, fine horses, spilling up the great driveway to the Neville mansion.
Like a grand funeral procession.
Appropriate.
Or not. What is fitting when one's honored guest is death himself?
Finest musicians in London. But for all their lovely notes, not a single couple steps onto the dance floor. No young lord begs the honor of the first dance with Lady Neville. Everyone clusters against the walls, in corners.
Why have they come to my party if they're afraid? I will die sooner than anyone here, but I'm not afraid. Entertaining death.
excites me.
Excites or frightens you? Your scarf is twisted in knots and you cannot sit down without rising again.
David, fetch me a glass of red wine.
I've brought you seven, my lady. One sip and you set it down and forget it.
I do. Where is...
Death? Where indeed? Far from punctual, I'm afraid.
Death will not arrive until midnight. I feel it.
Striking midnight.
What form will death take?
Or what disguise? Don't distress yourself.
Death will have my face.
He has not come.
There, my darling. I tell you, nothing to be afraid of. The whole thing's a joke.
A hoax?
Death will not be invited again.
Laramond, I am ruined. I wanted to give a ball so grand that those not invited would be publicly shamed. But how could I want to shame even their majesties? This humiliation is my reward.
No.
I am ruined and I deserve it. On my spite.
Don't think that.
David, get everyone dancing. Signal the orchestra.
Yes.
Play!
Music will drown out all this mockery.
Dance with me, David Lorimond. You will not have another chance. I shall never again give a party.
I am honored, Lady Neville, to have been invited to this, your last ball.
Let them laugh. I did not fear death when they were all trembling. Why should I fear their laughter now?
What is that?
This cool chill suddenly through the house.
Am I late? Oh, I am so sorry.
Before the footman can announce her, a lovely young girl in a white dress slips gracefully into the ballroom and glances about, smiling.
Can that be she? I must go and greet her.
Lady Neville, be careful. Take care.
How incredibly youthful, attractive, vibrant she is. Welcome, my Lady Death.
You are Lady Neville. Thank you for inviting me.
You honor us.
I must apologize, but I'd a long way to come, and my horse is tired.
Lady Death, I'll have one of the grooms feed your horses and rub them down.
Oh, no. Don't anyone go near my steeds. They're not real horses, and they're very fierce.
And you, milady? Real enough to accept this glass of wine?
Thank you. Everyone, upon getting to know me well, finds me very real.
I do not doubt it, dear Lady Death.
Beautiful house you have. I wish I lived here. I shall one day.
You what?
Oh, I'm sorry, Lady Neville. I'm cruel without wishing to be. I'm not used to this kind of hospitality. And I do stupid things. Please forgive me.
You have said nothing untoward. While you are my guest, my house is yours.
Oh, what lovely music. I have not danced in such a long time. I fear I've forgotten.
She is surprisingly shy.
What is wrong with all my young lords? Why is no one stepping forward to dance with her?
You wish me to?
No. David, stay by me.
I'm near fainting. Is it because she is deaf, that sweet young thing, that none of these gallants will chance a gavotte with her?
Oh, Lady Neville, look. Not all your gallants have failed you, Colonel Coulson.
My dear, exquisite young lady, may I have the honor of this dance?
I was hoping you'd ask, Colonel Coulson.
You know me?
I have seen you at a distance. Some brutal encounters I've had to attend. You are magnificent, Colonel.
For such a vivacious girl, I am surprised. Graceless dancing. No notion of music or rhythm.
The Colonel, though, keeping his dignity and humor.
But his eyes. Look at his eyes.
Oh, Lord. Glazed with fear.
Still, I have never seen him dance so well.
Inspires his lovely lady into flowing with him.
Yes. That comes of having military ideals to uphold.
Little by little, other couples overcome their fear and slip hurriedly onto the floor when death has her back to them. But no brave gallant tries to relieve Colonel Compson of his beautiful partner.
Ah, I'm getting the feel of the music now.
You are. If it is true...
Yes?
...that I saw you at some of those bloody battles, how can you have changed so? How can you be now so lovely?
I thought that among so many handsome people here tonight, it would be better to be beautiful.
Ah.
I was afraid of frightening everyone and spoiling the party.
Well, most of your guests, Lady Neville, thought she would be ugly.
But you, David, knew she would be beautiful.
The musicians play on and on. Lady Neville dances with everyone except Death's captive, Colonel Compson. And now, no woman at the ball dances better than Death herself.
They're jealous of Death.
Passionately.
I am not jealous of her in the least, and not afraid of her. Who will not talk of this night for years to come?
Oh, what has happened?
Well, poor musicians cannot play forever. Exhausted.
Out the window. Look, the night is almost gone. I too must go.
Oh, no, no. Even though the dancing is done, you must stay a while longer, sweet death.
I've had a wonderfully worldly time. I will remember this night forever.
Then stay. A while longer.
Dear Colonel Compson, my first real gallant. Not tired of me yet.
Never. Do stay.
Lady Death, stay. So I may dance and talk with you. If Colonel Compson, who plays the harpsichord tolerably, will play.
Such gallants I have. A soldier and a poet. Oh, to be a woman. But this romancing comes too late. I must go.
My husband and I think you're charming. Beautiful, please stay.
Ah, gracious Lady Torrance. Terrified of me all evening. Clinging tightly to your husband.
No longer.
And the Contessa della Candini. Standing well back. Disapproving. Do you want me to stay? To be one of your friends?
I disapprove no longer. Nor do I envy your beauty. You are a true lady.
And you? And you? And you? All of you? Do you want me to live among you? To be death no more?
Yes.
You want me to visit your homes? Come to your parties? Wear the gowns you wear? Say the clever things you say? And will one of your gallants marry me? The rest of you dance at my wedding.
Oh, yes, stay, become one of us.
Be certain. Be sure, all of you. If one of you says, no, go away, then I must leave and never return. Do all of you want me?
Yes.
We are dull and stupid and grow old uselessly. Stay with us, Lady Death.
Very well. I shall stay. I will be deaf no more. but a woman. There is a price to pay. There is always a price. One of you must become deaf in my place. There must forever be death in the world. Will anyone choose, any of you, willingly, to be deaf in my place, so that I might be a woman? No one will offer? Then I must choose. And that is just, for that's how I became deaf. I never wanted to be this phantom. It makes me so happy that you want me to become worldly, mortal, a woman. I've searched a long time for people fond of me. Now I've only to choose someone to replace me, and it is done. The Contessa della Candini.
Me? Me?
No, death's vocation is beyond you. And not Colonel Compson of His Majesty's Household Cavalry. Too kind to become deaf. The task too cruel to him. The Colonel himself wants to die so badly.
Lady Death, must you be so shrewd, so cautious?
Not David Lorimond, the poet.
No?
You know so little of life. And I'm too attracted to you.
You hurt me. And quicken me.
Lord and Lady Torrance. Ah, you care too much for each other to take pride in being deaf.
You are less capricious, my lady, than we thought.
I was far from your age, Lady Neville, when I became deaf. What must it be like to be your age eventually?
I have been this old mortal far too long.
Lady Neville, the ideal one. I choose Lady Neville.
I am honored. But is there no one more worthy?
No one. No one so weary of being a human. No one who knows better how meaningless it is to be alive. No one else, certainly not here, with the power to treat life, the life of your hairdresser's child, say, as the meaningless thing it is. Death has a heart, but so empty. And your heart, Lady Neville, empty as a dry riverbed.
Not always. But yes, since widowhood.
You will be content as deaf, more than I. For I was very young when I became deaf. Still life hungry. But you are aged and close to the end.
Death comes toward Lady Neville, lightly, her deep eyes wide and fold the morning's red sun. Everyone else moves back. Lady Neville, pale, thin hands clenched, watches Death come toward her with graceful, dancing steps.
Lady Neville, we must kiss each other. That is the way I became Death. Quickly. Quickly. Oh, I cannot wait to be alive again.
You may not like it after a while.
Perhaps not. I'll not be as beautiful as I am. And people will not love me as they do now. But I will be a loved and loving woman. For a while. Then die as humans die. I have done my penance.
What penance? What was it you did? Why did you become death?
I don't remember. And you too will forget, in time.
Lady Death is smaller, slighter than Lady Neville, and so much younger. Perhaps like a daughter Lady Neville never had. Death lifts her head to kiss the old lady's cheek.
You will still be beautiful when I am ugly. Be kind to me then.
I promise.
Lady Neville's last human act. With dry, cracked lips, she kisses the soft, sweet-smelling cheek of young Lady Death.
got a break. But we'll be back real soon with some science fiction. I hope you like science fiction. I sure do. Next is an adaptation. Well, it's not really an adaptation. Mindwebs did not exactly do adaptations. What they did, as they did in this case with an Alfred Bester story, which was first published in September of 1941 in John Campbell's Astounding Science Fiction, is just to read the story. This simple approach has made MindWebs my absolute favorite radio program, even though it hasn't aired a new program since 1984. This program aired on November the 24th of 1978.
Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. This is Michael Hansen. The story this time is by Alfred Bester. Adam and No Eve. Copyright 1941 by Street and Smith. Must be the seacoast. Instinct told him, but more than instinct, the few shreds of knowledge that clung to his torn brain told him. The stars that had shone at night through the rare breaks in the clouds, and his compass that still pointed a trembling finger north. That was the strangest of all, Crane thought. The rubbled earth still retained its polarity. It was no longer a coast. There was no longer any sea. Only the faint line of what had been a cliff stretched north and south for endless miles. It was a line of gray ash, the same gray ash and cinders that lay behind him and stretched before him. Fine silt, knee-deep, that swirled up at every motion and choked him. Cinders that scudded in dense night clouds when the mad winds blew. Black dust that was churned to mud when the frequent rains fell. The sky was jet overhead. The heavy clouds rode high and were pierced with shafts of sunlight that marched swiftly over the earth. Where the light struck a cinder storm, it was filled with gusts of dancing, gleaming particles. And where it played through rain, it brought the arches of rainbows into being. Rain fell, cinder storms blew, light thrust down, together, alternately, and continually in a jigsaw of black and white violence. So it had been for months. So it was over every mile of the broad earth. Crane passed the edge of the ashen cliffs and began crawling down the even slope that had once been the ocean bed. He had been traveling so long that pain had become part of him. He braced elbows and dragged his body forward. Then he brought his right knee under him and reached forward with elbows again. Elbows, knee, elbows, knee. He had forgotten what it was to walk. Life, he thought dazedly, is miraculous. It adapts itself to anything. If it must crawl, it crawls. Crane said, I beg pardon? I didn't quite get that. But he peered up at the tall figure before him and tried to understand the words. It was Hallmeyer. He wore his stained lab coat. His gray hair was awry. Hallmeyer stood delicately on top of the ashes, and Crane wondered why he could see the scudding cinder clouds through his body.
How do you like your world, Stephen?
Hallmeyer asked.
Not very pretty, huh? Look around you. Dust, that's all. Dust and ashes. Crawl, Stephen, crawl. You'll find nothing but dust and ashes.
Hallmeyer produced a goblet of water from nowhere. It was clear and cold. Crane could see the fine mist of dew on its surface, and his mouth was suddenly coated with grit. Hallmeyer sipped and then spat in Crane's face. The water felt warm.
Keep crawling, Stephen. Crawl round and around the face of the earth. You'll find nothing but dust and ashes.
He emptied the goblet on the ground before Crane.
Keep crawling. How many miles? Figure it out for yourself. Pi times D. The diameter's 8,000 or so.
He was gone. Coat and goblet. Crane realized that rain was falling again. He pressed his face into the warm cinder mud, opened his mouth, and tried to suck the moisture. Presently, he began crawling again. There was an instinct that drove him on. He had to get somewhere. It was associated, he knew, with the sea, with the edge of the sea. At the shore of the sea, something waited for him, something that would help him understand all this. He had to get to the sea. That is, if there was a sea anymore. The thundering rain beat his back like heavy planks. Crane paused and yanked the knapsack around to his side where he probed in it with one hand. It contained exactly three things, a gun, a bar of chocolate, and a can of peaches, all that was left of 2 months' supplies. As he munched the fruit and sipped the juice, he watched the wall of rain marching before him down the slope of the ocean bed. Torrents of water were gushing through the mud. Small channels had already been cut, channels that would be new rivers someday. A day he would never see, a day that no living thing would ever see. As he flipped the empty can aside, Crane thought, the last living thing on Earth eats its last meal. Metabolism begins the last act. And then Evelyn was tapping his shoulder. Crane knew it was she before he turned his head.
Stephen, you've got to hurry. Oh, darling, you've been hurt.
Yeah, I got it landing. I wasn't used to a parachute. I always thought you came down gently, like plumping onto a bed. But the earth came up at me like a fist, and Umber was fighting around in my arms, and I couldn't let him drop, could I?
Of course not, dear.
So I just held onto him and tried to get my legs under me, and then something smashed my legs inside. Evelyn, darling.
No, dear, you've got to hurry. You've got to watch out behind.
The cinder storms, you mean? Oh, I've been through them before.
Not the storms. Something else. Oh, Stephen.
Then she was gone. But Crane knew she had spoken the truth. There was something behind. Something that had been following him. Somehow that was impossible. He was the last living thing on Earth. How could there be a menace? The wind roared behind him. And an instant later came the heavy clouds of cinders and ashes. The storm whipped up a great bewilderment in his sick head. Like a child, he pushed at the pieces of his memory, trying to fit them together. Why was Hallmeyer so bitter toward him? It couldn't have been that argument, could it? The one before all this happened? Abruptly, the pieces locked together. Crane stood alongside the sleek lines of his ship and admired it tremendously. The roof of the shed had been removed and the nose of the ship hoisted so that it rested on a cradle pointed toward the sky. A workman was carefully burnishing the inner surfaces of the rocket jets. He looked up and grinned. Crane knew what he was thinking, that the ship would tear itself apart. Everyone said that. Everyone except Evelyn. She had faith in him. Hallmeyer never said it either, but Hallmeyer thought he was crazy in another way. As he descended the ladder, Crane saw Hallmeyer come into the shed, lab coat flying. Hallmeyer dug a sheaf of papers out of his pocket and waved it under Crane's nose.
I've been up half the night working it through again, Stephen. I tell you, I'm right. I'm absolutely right. For the last time, Stephen. Look, you're using your new catalyst on iron solution. All right, I grant it's a miraculous discovery. I give you credit for that. Miraculous was hardly the word for it. Crane knew that without conceit, for he realized that he had only stumbled on it. You had to stumble on a catalyst that would induce atomic disintegration of iron and give 100 billion foot-pounds of energy for every gram of fuel. No man was smart enough to think all that up by himself. You don't think I'll make it, Hallmeyer?
To the moon? Around the moon? Maybe. You've got a 50-50 chance, but for God's sake, Stephen, I'm not worried about you. If you want to kill yourself, that's your own affair. It's the Earth I'm worried about. No matter how you work the feed and mixing system, you can't get 100% efficiency in mixing and discharge.
Well, that's what makes it a 50-50 chance, so what's bothering you?
The catalyst that'll escape through the rocket tubes, that's what. You realize what it'll do if a drop hits Earth? It'll start a chain of disintegration that'll envelop the globe. It'll reach out to every atom of iron, and there's iron everywhere. There won't be any Earth left for you to return to.
Listen, we've been through all this before. Crane took Hallmeyer to the base of the rocket cradle. Beneath the iron framework was a 200-foot pit, 50 feet wide, lined with fire brick. Look, that's for the initial discharge flames. If any of the catalyst goes through, it'll be trapped in that pit and taken care of by the secondary reactions. Now you're satisfied?
But while you're in flight, you'll be endangering the Earth until you're beyond Roche's limit. Every drop of non-activated catalyst will eventually sink back to the ground and...
Look, for the last time, the flame of the rocket discharge takes care of that, Hallmeyer. It'll envelop any escaped particles and destroy them. Now, get out of here, will you? I've got work to do. Work? No, it was sheer intoxication to labor over the ship. She lay in the cradle, ready to pierce the skies, 50 feet of slender steel, the rivet heads gleaming like jewels. The ship's nose was a porthole of natural crystal that stared upward like a cyclopean eye. Crane thought, the ship will die after this trip. She'll return to Earth and smash in a blaze of fire and thunder. But it's worth it. She'll have had her one great flight. And that's all any of us should want. One great, beautiful flight into the unknown. As he unlocked the workshop door, Crane heard Hallmeyer shouting from the cottage across the fields.
It's Evelyn on the phone.
Well, what's the idea? I thought we agreed that she wasn't to call, wasn't to get in touch with me until I was ready to start. You've been putting ideas into her head, Hallmeyer. Is this the way you think you're going to stop me? Then Crane went into the study and picked up the phone. Now listen, darling. There's no sense in getting alarmed. I explained everything very carefully. See, just before the ship crashes, I take to a parachute. I love you very much. I'll see you Wednesday when I start. So long.
Goodbye, sweetheart. And is that what you called me for?
I called you? A brown hulk disengaged itself from the hearthrug and lifted itself to strong legs. Umber, Crane's Mastiff, sniffed and cocked an ear, and then he whined. Evelyn, did you say I called you? Umber's throat suddenly poured forth a bellow, and he reached Crane in a single bound, looked up into his face and whined and roared all at once. Come, shut up, you monster. And he pushed Umber away with his foot.
Give Umber a kick for me. Yes, dear. Someone called and said you wanted to speak to me.
They did, huh? Oh, look, honey, I'll call you back. Crane hung up. He arose doubtfully and watched Umber's uneasy actions. Through the windows, the late evening glow sent flickering shadows of orange light. Umber gazed at the light, sniffed and bellowed again, and suddenly struck Crane, leaped to the window. Across the fields, a mass of flame thrust high into the air, and within it were the crumbling walls of the workshop. Crane shot out of the cottage and, with Umber hard at his heels, sprinted toward the shed. As he ran, he could see the graceful nose of the spaceship within the fire, still looking cool, untouched. If only he could reach it before the flame softened its metal and started the rivets. Hallmeyer pushed through the crowd. His eyes gleamed with triumph.
Too bad. I'm sorry, Stephen.
You bastard, Crane shouted and grasped Hallmeyer by the lapels and shook him. Then he dropped in and started into the shed. Hallmeyer snapped orders to the workmen, and an instant later a body hurtled against Crane's calves and spilled him to the ground. He lurched to his feet, fists swinging. Umber was alongside, growling over the roar of the flames. Crane battered a man in the face and saw him stagger back against a second. He lifted a knee in a vicious drive that sent the last workman crumpling to the ground, and then he ducked his head and plunged into the workshop. The Scorch felt cool at first, but when he reached the ladder and began mounting to the port, he screamed with the agony of his burns. Umber was howling at the foot of the ladder, and Crane realized that the dog could never escape from the rocket blasts. He reached down and hauled Umber into the ship. Crane was reeling as he closed and locked the port. His fingers tripped the switches on the control board. The ship shuddered and roared, and blackness descended over Crane. He was lying curled in a cup of the crystal nose. The ship had risen high, perhaps almost to Roche's zone, to the limit of the Earth's gravitational attraction. But then, without guiding hands at the controls to continue its flight, it had turned and was dropping back toward Earth. Crane peered through the crystal and gasped. Below him was the ball of the Earth. It looked three times the size of the moon. And it was no longer his Earth. It was a globe of fire mottled with black clouds. At the northernmost pole, there was a tiny patch of white. And even as Crane watched, it was suddenly blotted over with hazy tones of red, scarlet, and crimson. Hallmeyer had been right. Crane lay frozen in the cup of the nose as the ship descended, watching the flames gradually fade away to leave nothing but the dense blanket of black around the Earth. He lay numb with horror, unable to understand, unable to reckon up a people snuffed out, a green, fair planet reduced to ashes and cinders. Everything that was once dear and close to him, gone. The instinct of life forced him to action. He climbed up to the store chest and prepared for the landing. Parachute, a small oxygen tank, a knapsack of supplies. Only half aware of what he was doing, he dressed for the descent, buckled down the chute and opened the port. Umber whined pathetically, and he took the heavy dog in his arms and stepped out into space. Every breath was a lungful of ground glass or ashes or cinders. He had returned to a suffocating black presence that hugged him with soft weight and made him fight for breath. Crane struggled in panic and then relaxed. It had happened before. A long time passed, he'd been buried deep under ashes when he'd stopped to remember. Weeks ago, days, or months, Crane clawed with his hands, inching out of the mound of cinders that the wind had thrown around him. Presently, he emerged into the light again. The wind had died away. It was time to begin his crawl to the sea once more. The vivid pictures of his memory scattered again before the grim vista that stretched out ahead. Crane scowled. He remembered too much, too often. He thought, I'm the only one. I'm the last memory on Earth. I'm the last life. He crawled, elbows, knee. And then Hallmeyer was crawling alongside and making a great game of it. He chortled and plunged in the cinders like a happy sea lion. And Crane said, but why do we have to get to the sea? Hallmeyer blew a spume of ashes. Ask her! And he pointed to Crane's other side. Evelyn was there, crawling seriously, intently, mimicking Crane's smallest action.
It's because of our house. You remember our house, darling? High on the cliff. We were going to live there forever and ever. I was there when you left. Now you're coming back to the house at the edge of the sea. Your beautiful flight is over, dear, and you're coming back to me. We'll live together, just we two, like Adam and Eve. Oh, Stephen, watch out!
And Crane felt the menace closing in on him again. Still crawling, he stared back at the vast gray plains of ash and saw nothing. When he looked at Evelyn again, he saw only his shadow, sharp and black. Presently, it too faded away as the marching shaft of sunlight passed. But the dread remained. Evelyn had warned him twice, and she was always right. Crane stopped and turned, and settled himself to watch. If he was really being followed, he would see whatever it was coming along his tracks. There was a painful moment of lucidity. I'm mad, he thought. There is no Evelyn, no Hallmeyer, no menace. In all this land, there is no life but mine. And even ghosts and spirits of the underworld must have perished in the inferno that girdled the planet. No, there is nothing but me and my sickness. I'm dying. And when I perish, everything will perish. Only a mass of lifeless cinders will go on. But there was a movement. Yes, there. A quarter mile back, a gray-brown shape was floating along the gray surface. Despite the drone of the distant rain, Crane could hear the whisper of trodden cinders and see the little clouds kicking up. The thing approached, and suddenly Crane squinted and understood. He recalled Umber, kicking with fear and springing away from him when the parachute landed them on the ashen face of the earth. Why, it's Umber. He raised himself. The dog halted.
Here, boy, here.
He was overcome with joy. He realized that loneliness had hung over him, a horrible sensation of oneness in emptiness. Now, his was not the only life. There was another, a friendly life that could offer love and companionship. Hope kindled again. But the mastiff hung back, showing its fangs and a lolling tongue. The dog was emaciated, and its eyes gleamed red in the dusk. As Crane called once more, the dog snarled.
He's hungry, Crane thought. He's hungry, that's all.
He reached into the knapsack, and at the gesture, the dog snarled again. Crane withdrew the chocolate bar and laboriously peeled off the paper and silver foil. Weakly, he tossed it toward Umber. It fell far short. After a minute of savage uncertainty, the dog advanced slowly and snapped up the food. Ashes powdered its muzzle. It licked its chops ceaselessly and continued to advance on Crane. Panic chirped within him. A voice persisted. This is no friend. Love and companionship have vanished from the land along with life. Now there is nothing left but hunger. Umber was advancing with a slinking sidle, and his teeth showed sharp and white. And even as Crane stared at him, the dog snarled and lunged. Crane thrust up an arm under the dog's muzzle, and with his free hand he struck weakly again and again, scarcely feeling the grind of teeth on his left arm. And then something metallic pressed under him, and he realized he was lying on his revolver. As Umber let go his arm and tore at his throat, Crane brought the gun up and jabbed the muzzle blindly against the dog's body. He pulled and pulled the trigger until the roars died away, and only empty clicks sounded. Umber shuddered in the ashes before him, his body nearly shot in two. Evelyn and Hallmeyer looked down sadly at the broken animal. Evelyn was crying. Hallmeyer reached nervous fingers through his hair in the same old gesture.
This is the finish, Stephen. You've killed part of yourself. Oh, you'll go on living, but not all of you. You'd best burn that body, Stephen. It's the corpse of your soul.
It seemed that they helped him thrust the dead dog into his knapsack. They helped him take off his clothes and pack them underneath. They cupped their hands around the matches until the cloth caught fire and blew on the weak flame until it sputtered and burned limply. Crane crouched by the fire and nursed it. Then he turned and once again began crawling down the ocean bed. He was naked now. There was nothing left of what had been but his flickering little life. He was too heavy with sorrow to notice the furious rain that slammed and buffeted him, or the searing pains through his blackened leg and up his hip. He crawled, elbows, knee, elbows, knee. Woodenly, mechanically, apathetic to everything, even to the dull glint of water that lay far ahead. He knew it was the sea, what was left of the old, or a new one in the making. But it would be an empty, lifeless sea that someday would lap against a dry, lifeless shore. This would be a planet of stone and dust, of metal
and snow and ice and water, but that would be all. No more life. He, alone, was useless. He was Adam, but there was no Eve. Here, at last, is the sea, Crane thought. And here am I, Adam, and no Eve. It's hopeless. He rolled a little farther into the waters. They laved his torn body. He lay with face to the sky, peering at the high, menacing heavens, and the bitterness within him welled up. It's not right. It's not right that all this should pass away. Life is too beautiful to perish at the mad act of one mad creature. Quietly, the waters laved him. Quietly, calmly. The sea rocked him gently, and even the death that was reaching up toward his heart was no more than a gloved hand. Suddenly, the skies split apart for the first time in all those months, and Crane stared up at the stars. Then he knew this was not the end of life. There could never be an end to life. Within his body, within the rotting tissues rocking gently in the sea, was the source of 10 million lives. Cells, tissues, bacteria, amoeba. Countless infinities of life that would take new root in the waters and live long after he was gone. They would live on his rotting remains. They would feed on each other. They would adapt themselves to the new environment and feed on the minerals and sediments washed into this new sea. They would grow, burgeon, evolve. Life would reach out to the lands once more. It would begin again, the same old repeated cycle that had begun perhaps with the rotting corpse of some last survivor of interstellar travel. It would happen over and over in the future ages. And then he knew what had brought him back to the sea. There need be no Adam, no Eve. Only the sea, the great mother of life, was needed. The sea had called him back to her depths that presently life might emerge once more, and he was content. Quietly, the waters comforted him. Quietly, calmly, the mother of life rocked the last born of the old cycle, who would become the firstborn of the new. And with blazing eyes, Stephen Crane smiled up at the stars. Stars that were sprinkled evenly across the sky. Stars that had not yet formed into the familiar constellations and would not for another 100 million centuries. That was Adam and No Eve, a story by Alfred Bester, copyright 1941, by Street and Smith. This is Michael Hansen, technical production for this broadcast by Bob Chan. Mind Webs is produced at WHA Radio in Madison, a service of University of Wisconsin Extension.
Queen's Minute Mysteries. This is Ellery Queen with the case I call the Whiskey Mystery. When Gaylord Leonard called me to help authenticate a new find of his, another in his collection of pirate lore, I rushed to his house. At the entrance to his library was a cask, the kind used to store rum. It was carved with a traditional skull and crossbones and signed Bartholomew Roberts. We knew that Roberts was a notorious pirate, But both Leonard and I also knew the cast was a swindler's work of art. In a moment, I'll tell you how we knew.
Mayfield. Fresh new way to smoke. A fresh new kind of cigarette. Mayfield. The smoothest thing that's happened to smoking since the filter. Mayfield. With just enough menthol to smooth out the smoke, but not enough to blur the taste of the good tobaccos.
In the case of the whiskey mystery, I knew that the pirate Roberts was a teetotaler. He also wouldn't allow gambling or women on his ships, so the rum cask with his signature was a bloody fake.
Listen again to Ellery Queen's Minute Mysteries.
Sleep No More ran in 1956 and 1957. It is quite similar to the preceding program, Mind Webs, in that what happens here is they just read you a story. In this case, there's really only one voice, that of Mr. Nelson Olmsted. And tonight there are two stories by pretty prominent writers. Christopher Isherwood's story that was originally published in The New Yorker for October the 21st of 1939, I Am Waiting. The second story is a story by A.M. Burridge, originally published in his collection of short stories called Some Ghost Stories in 1927.
This is Nelson Olmsted. Sleep no more. Sleep no more. Turn down the lights. Sink back in your chair and don't look into the shadows. In the shadows, there may be moving things. Tonight, it may be, you will sleep no more. Good evening. This is Ben Grauer introducing tonight's tale of terror, told by Nelson Olmsted on the National Broadcasting Company's presentation of Sleep No More. The story of terror can be as simple as a sheeted ghost rattling chains. It can be a complex and hidden world of horror, lurking in such unholy dimensions as only the dead and the moonstruck can glimpse. Or it can be those terrible, fathomless shadows which lie buried deep in the primitive mind of civilized man. And for this evening, well, Nelson Olmsted, tell us about this evening's story.
Thank you, Ben. Our first story tonight was written by the British author Christopher Isherwood.
Oh, he's the one who wrote the novel from which the play and movie I'm a Camera was adapted.
That's right. But this tale is in a quite different mood. It's a strange story of a man who, through some peculiar quirk, is able to get brief glimpses into the future.
What's it called?
I Am Waiting.
We all are.
The incidents which I am about to describe are true, but I can offer you no proof, at least not for the next 5 years. By that time, you will probably have forgotten that you ever heard this story. So please believe it or disbelieve it just as you wish. Today is my birthday. I am what you or anybody else would call a failure. I have no career, no outstanding achievements behind me. I've never been married, and I can truthfully say that I've never been loved, though half a dozen people are perhaps mildly fond of me. I live in a pleasant house in the outskirts of a town not far from Hartford, Connecticut. The house belongs to my younger brother, a successful and energetic lawyer. Mabel, my brother's wife, is very kind to me on the whole, as long as I'm careful to be tidy and not unnecessarily visible. With reference to the story which follows, I need only add that I have never at any time had reason to believe that I possessed psychic powers. But on the evening of Friday, July 6th of last year,
I was sitting in the drawing room of our house alone. The others had all driven into town to go to a movie, so I could enjoy the luxury of drawing my armchair into the very middle of the hearth rug, facing and monopolizing the fire. The time was about 9:20. I remember this because I kept glancing at the clock in the mantelpiece in order to be ready to turn on the radio and listen to the news bulletin. The clock is a wedding present given to my brother by the members of his firm. It's made of china and is vaguely supposed to be valuable, with a boy and a girl in peasant costumes supporting the clock itself. I may have dozed off, as I so often do. At any rate, I'd closed my eyes, and when I reopened them, it was with a violent start, as though somebody had called my name. Perhaps the others had returned unexpectedly early. Some such thought passed through my mind, but I didn't turn my head. I don't know why. All my drowsy attention was focused upon the clock, and what I immediately noticed was that the left hand was missing from the china figure of the peasant boy. It's very difficult for me to describe my precise sensations at that moment. I saw only that the hand had been broken off. I wondered how long it had been broken, and was surprised that I had never noticed it before. Mabel would be cross, I thought, and this led me to fear that I might somehow have done the damage myself while I was asleep. I rubbed my eyes and sat up suddenly in my chair, and I blinked several times. How absurd. I must have been dreaming. For now, as I examined the clock, fully awake, I saw that I'd made a mistake. The clock wasn't damaged. After all, the china hand was still intact. Well, one morning, about a week later, when I was walking in the garden, Mabel came out of the house and confided to me that she would have to fire the new maid because she had broken the drawing-room clock. Well, I pushed past her toward the French windows which opened into the drawing-room. Entering, I saw what, in my excitement, I had dimly expected to see. The china boy's left hand was broken off at the wrist. The second occurrence took place at 11:25 a.m. on Monday, August 20th. I was in my bedroom standing near a bookcase which occupies the corner behind my bed. It was a gray morning. Although, from where I stood, I could not see out of the window, I knew by the pattering sound on the glass that it had begun to rain. As I reached out my hand for a book, I experienced an extraordinary sensation which swept over me, leaving my body tingling and trembling and the sweat breaking out of my forehead. I stood there as if frozen with my hand outstretched. What followed cannot have taken more than a minute. Perhaps it occupied only a few seconds. At first, I was aware only of a change of mood, very difficult to describe. I felt lighter, happier, as though some oppression had been lifted from my mind. Lighter. Yes, that was the exact word, for the room was actually full of light, of bright sunshine. As I stood, I began not only to feel and see, but to hear also. Sounds were coming up through the window from the garden below. I heard laughter, voices, and the noise of a tennis ball being hit back and forth across the net. And then one voice called out,
"Come on, Joyce! Give them everything! They're beginning to crack!"
It was my youngest nephew. Joyce is the name of his sister-in-law, my eldest nephew's wife. No words of mine to describe the strangeness of these familiar words and sounds. I listened to them as a dead man might listen to the voices of the living. They were so near to me, and yet so immeasurably remote. And I heard Joyce say,
"Oh, tricky, very tricky."
And Bob, my eldest nephew, answered,
"What do you think you're playing, ping pong?"
That was all. The next moment, the contact, or whatever you'd like to call it, was broken. My fingers had touched the book, and there I was back in the gray, clear continuity of normal consciousness with the rain pattering fast in the pane. Well, I forget exactly what I did next. I think I must have paced the room several times, backward and forward, pausing to look down through the window at the wet tennis court in the empty garden below. I was deeply excited and disturbed. Although it still wasn't entirely clear what had happened to me, I was aware that something had happened, something so dimly tremendous that it dwarfed every other experience of my whole life. I carefully wrote down what I had heard and seen as I've described it here. And when I finished, I felt very tired. I lay down on my bed and slept soundly till lunch. Early in the fall, Jack, my youngest nephew, came to visit us. The fine weather had continued and the tennis court was still in good condition. Whenever anybody spoke of tennis, I felt my pulse throb with suppressed excitement. But where were the other actors in the strange, meaningless little drama I hoped to witness? I repeatedly asked Mabel and my brother if Bob and Joyce were expected. No, they said not yet. They wouldn't be likely to visit us before December. Well, on the afternoon of Saturday, November 3rd, I returned by bus from shopping in town. It was about 3:15. I went to my room, and as I moved to the bookcase, I heard Jack's voice on the lawn below calling the score.
15 all. Come on, Joyce, give them everything. They're beginning to crack.
It was there. My moment. And even as with a gasp I recognized that it was past, it flashed by me and was gone. Long before I recovered my wits sufficiently to hurry to the window, the actors had spoken their familiar lines. The drama was over. Looking down into the garden, I saw Jack, Bob, and Joyce, and a strange girl chatting and joking across the net at the end of their game. The girl was a friend of Joyce's. She had been brought over in the car from Providence, Rhode Island, I discovered. When Bob planned this surprise visit, he had come to stay the weekend. Almost exactly 2 weeks later, on the afternoon of Sunday, November 18th, I had gone into the trunk room to hunt for some old photographs. The trunk room is at the top of the house. It has no windows, only a skylight let into the roof. It is crowded with bits of damaged furniture, cardboard boxes, and old trunks. Wondering where to begin my search, I decided upon a scarred Gladstone bag, which I opened. And then, as I bent over the papers, the attack seized me. This time, the sensations were different and incomparably more violent. My ears began to sing, my limbs stiffened, and a convulsion like an electric shock seemed to take place at the base of my spine. Half fainting, breathless, dizzy, I had barely time to think, it's going to happen again. And then I closed my eyes. Gradually, my arms and legs relaxed, my head cleared, and I began to inhale deeply and easily. The sense of relief was exquisite. Very cautiously, I opened my eyes and looked about me. At first, I hardly recognized the room in which I found myself. It was the same room, but the papers, the trunks, and the furniture had all disappeared. The floor on which I knelt seemed to have been recently scrubbed. For several minutes, I didn't move. I was scared, of course, but much more excited than scared. Rising to my feet, I walked over and turned the handle of the door. It was locked. For some moments, I stood stupidly twisting the knob in my hand, and then I began to rattle it and to beat the panel with my fist, and finally I shouted aloud, "Let me out! Let me out!" There was no answer. After a while, I stopped. It was no good. The house was empty. Slowly, I returned to the middle of the room. It was then that I made my great discovery. In the shadows on the far corner, crumpled against the baseboard, lay some dirty sheets of paper. Sitting down upon the floor, I smoothed them out with trembling hands. They were the inside pages of a magazine. I read its name, The Cage Bird Fancier, and the date, July 1962. Only an archaeologist can imagine the intensity of my excitement at that moment. Here was an actual tiny fragment of the future itself, palpable to my present-day fingers. It had been manufactured by men who could answer offhand many of those burning questions which still perplex the wisest mortals of 1957. Shaking with eagerness, I began to read. I suppose I was very silly. My mind shouted questions. Had the United States jumped into war again? Had there been a revolution? What's happening in Europe, in China, in the Near East? And the men of the future, as if teasing my impatience, would only answer, "It is rather difficult to give exact dimensions for stock cages, as they often have to be built to suit the individual canary breeder's accommodations." For all the information it gave me, the cage bird fancier might equally well have been written in Turkish or Japanese. Yet I read on, learning all manner of highly relevant and unfruitful facts, that the legs of a canary will sometimes denote its approximate age, that narrow perches are best for birds which have slipped claw. These tiresome details are imprinted upon my memory forever, but nowhere, nowhere could I find a trace of any wider implication. And even as my eyes hurried along the last lines of the print, I knew in the deepest marrow of my bones that I had outstayed my welcome. I protested, but the singing noise was growing fast. Clenching the papers in my two fists like a fraying lifeline, I pitched forward into oblivion. When I recovered consciousness, I found myself in bed, in my own room, with Mabel hovering anxiously around me. It was she who had discovered me when she came upstairs to call me down to tea, lying senseless on the trunk room floor. And I asked, was there anything in my hand? Oh, yes. You found them all right. Don't you remember? Found them? Oh, yes. The photographs. One of them's rather crumpled, but I'll iron it out. And now, you're not to talk anymore. The doctor will be here in a moment. Well, the doctor, when he arrived, could find nothing much the matter. He advised a thorough rest. Both he and Mabel were curious to know the exact circumstances under which my fainting fit took place, and I answered their questions as vaguely as possible. I decided, of course, to tell them nothing. I have no wish to end my days in a mental home. And now, here I am, waiting for whatever may come next. Sometimes I feel frightened, but in general I manage to regard the whole business quite philosophically. I am well aware that the next adventure, if there ever is another, may be my last. The conditions of time travel may prove too violent for my elderly frame. Perhaps I shan't survive the journey. But I wouldn't refuse to make it on that account, even if I could. What other experience can be comparable to this? What else have I to live for now? So let the moment call for me whenever it will, at whatever time, in whatever place. I shall be ready.
And so we leave our friend to wait and to wonder. That was the story, I Am Waiting, by Christopher Isherwood. Now, Mr. Olmsted, for our second story.
Well, our second offering, Ben, is also by an English writer. His A.M. Burridge. It's about a particularly eerie place which was haunted for a purpose. He calls it Browdean Farm. Most people with limited vocabulary, such as mine, would describe Browdean Farm loosely and comprehensively as picturesque. The house was quite a surprise to us. It showed few signs of damp, considering the length of time it had been untenanted, and it needed little in the way of repairs. I inquired about the rent. It was astonishingly low. My friend, Rudge Jefferson, had to live somewhere while he finished a book, and I could look forward to some months of idleness before returning to the United States. We decided to take it. We'd been at the farm about a month before Rudge Jefferson began to show symptoms of nerves. I thought he was working too hard. It was about that time that I, walking homeward one morning, just about lunchtime, I met the local policeman just outside the village inn. Oh, he was friendly enough, so I invited him in for some ale. And he asked me how we were getting on up at the farm. Well, admirably, I told him. And then he looked at me closely as if to see if I were sincere, or rather to search my eyes for the passing of some afterthought. And then he said, well, sir, if anything happens up at the farm, you needn't go talking about it. We've done our best now. What's passed is passed and can't be altered. There ain't no sense in setting people against us. He didn't look at me while he spoke. 2 evenings later, which is to say the evening of May the 21st, I returned home at 9:30, full of suppressed excitement. I had a story to tell Rudge, and I was yet not sure if I should be wise in telling it. His nerves had grown worse during the past 2 days. Rather to my surprise, he wasn't in his room working. 2 minutes later, while I was reading what he'd left in his typewriter, I heard the gate click and footfalls on the path. Naturally, I guessed that Rudge, temperamental as he was, had suddenly tired of his work and gone out for a walk. I heard the footsteps come to within a few yards of the house when they left the path, fell softer on grass and weeds, and approached the window. The curtain obscured my view, but on the glass I heard the tap of fingertips, and I called out, "Righto!" and went around to the front door to let him in. Having opened the front door, I leaned out and saw him, Rudge, I imagined, peering in the study window. He was no more than a dark, bent shadow in the dusk with a soft felt hat such as he generally wore. "Righto!" I said again, and I hurried to the kitchen to put our supper on the table. I remember that as I walked through to the sink, one of the beams over my head creaked noisily. Well, he produced a book at supper and sat scowling at it over his left arm while we ate. This was permitted by our rules, but I had something to tell him, and after a while I said, "Rudge, I've made a discovery this evening. I know how we got this place so cheap." He sat up with a start, and he said, "Well, how?" "Well, this is Stanley Stride's old house. Remember him?" Well, he was pale already, but I saw him turn paler still. He said, "Yes, I remember the name vaguely. Wasn't he a murderer?"
"He was. I didn't remember the case very well, but my memory's been refreshed today. Everybody here thought we knew. It was rather a grisly business, and the odd thing is that local opinion is all in favor of Stride's innocence, although he was hanged."
"Yes, I remember the name, but I forget the case. Now tell me."
"Well, Stanley Stride was an artist who rented this place. He got himself entangled with the daughter of a neighboring farmer and found himself compelled to marry her. At the same time, he fell in love with another girl, so he lured the old one here and murdered her. He buried the body and afterwards tried to make out she'd committed suicide. So, of course, the house is haunted."
"So I don't know about haunted, but it's been a devilish house to sit in for the past few evenings. I mean, at twilight when I've been waiting for you. My nerves have been pretty raw lately. Tonight I couldn't stand it, so I went out for a stroll.
Oh, yes. By the way, what made you go out the second time?
I didn't. But, my dear chap, you did. Because the first time you came in, you wore a hat, and 2 minutes later I saw you walking up the garden path without one. Well, no, that's when I did come back. I haven't worn a hat all this evening. And that reminds me, when you come in of an evening, you needn't sneak up to the window and tap on it with your fingers. It doesn't frighten me, and it's disconcerting. You can always walk into the room and let me know that you've come back. But, my dear chap, I've done no such thing.
Why, you old liar. You've been doing it every evening for the past week, until tonight, when I didn't give you the chance.
I swear I haven't, Rudge. But if you thought that, it explains why you did the same thing to me tonight.
I didn't even come near the window.
But then who was the man I saw peering in? I saw him from the door.
Well, it seems we've got our ghosts, after all. At that moment, we heard a scuffling sound from the kitchen, followed by the creaking of tin, much louder than before. Rudge moved in his chair and he said, Now, don't laugh at me. I know this is all right, but I've got a hideous feeling that things hidden and unseen around us are moving steadily to a crisis.
Well, you cheerful brute.
Yes, I know. It's only my nerves, of course. I don't want to infect you with them. But the noises we hear and the fellow who comes and taps at the window now, they want some explaining away now, don't they?
Yeah. Especially now that we know somebody was murdered here. I'm beginning to wish we didn't know about that.
That night, I read in the parlor and fell asleep over my book. And just as the lamp was burning out the last of its fuel, I awoke. And as I watched the last flutterings of the lamp, I became suddenly aware of the cause of my waking. I had heard the latch snap on the garden gate, and in that moment, I began to hear them, the footfalls. I heard the rhythmic crunch of gravel, and then the swish of long grass, and then the shadow knotted on the blind. It loomed up large and suddenly became stationary. A loose pane rattled under the impact of fingers. I saw only the head and shoulders of a man who wore a dented felt hat. His head lolled over onto his left shoulder, just as I'd always imagined a man's head would loll if he had been hanged. And I knew in my blood that he was a ghost and that he wanted me for something. I felt my hair bristle, and suddenly I was streaming with sweat. I don't remember turning and running, but I have a vague recollection of bouncing off the doorpost and stumbling in the hall. And when I reached my bed, I don't know if I fainted or fell asleep. No, I didn't tell Rudge the next day. His nerves were in a bad enough state already, but I did question Mrs. James, our charwoman, when she arrived, and I saw a look half stubborn and half guilty across her face. Yes, of course, she remembered the murder happening, but she didn't remember much about it. Mr. Stride was quite a nice gentleman, although rather one for the ladies. And Stride's defense was that the poor girl had committed suicide and that he'd lost his head and buried the body when he found it. Lots of people thought that was true, but they hanged Mr. Stride for it all the same, and that was all I could get out of Mrs. James. Well, that morning, when I called at the inn for my usual glass of beer, I asked the landlord if he would tell me the date of the murder, and he said,
Well, yes, sir. It was May the... Why, it was 8 years ago tonight.
Well, that evening, I went out again and came in at the usual hour, and Rudge came down the path to meet me. He was white and sick-looking, and he said,
He's been here again half an hour ago.
You saw him this time?
Yes. I did as you did and went around to the door. He is a ghost, you know.
Well, what happened?
Oh, I went around to the door when I heard him tapping at the window, and there he was, as you saw him yesterday evening, trying to look in through and into the room. He must have heard me, for he turned and stared, and his head was all drooping on one side like a poppy in a broken stem, and he came toward me, and I couldn't stand that, so I turned and I ran into the house and locked the door.
Well, after a pause, I said, Rudge, this is the anniversary of the murder. Yeah, I should think something worse would happen tonight. Shall we see it through, or shall we beat it? And almost in a whisper, Rudge said,
Poor devil. He wants to tell us something, you know.
Yes. Or show us something.
So,
We agreed to stay. We were left in peace until just after 11 o'clock, when once more we heard the garden gate being opened at footfalls. We could see nothing, for our lamp was lit. But I knew what it looked like, the thing that stood outside and now tapped softly on the glass. And in spite of having run for company, I lost my head and I screamed at it, "Get back! Whatever you are, get back to hell!" And it was Rudge who kept his head. He called out, No, come in. Come in if we can help you." The front door was locked, but it was no barrier to our visitor. We heard slow footfalls shuffling through the hall. I died a thousand deaths as they approached the door of our room, but they passed and died away up the passage. And then I heard a whisper from Rudge.
"He's gone through into the kitchen. I think he wants us to follow."
Well, I shouldn't have gone if Rudge hadn't half dragged me by the hand. The kitchen door was closed. Rudge held his breath for a moment, lifted the latch, and took a quick step across the threshold. And in that same instant, he froze my chilled blood with a scream such as I had heard in wartime from a wounded horse. He had almost fainted when he returned and fell into my arms. I half dragged, half carried him into the dining room and gave him a brandy. And suddenly I became aware that a great peace had settled upon the house. I can only compare it to the freshness and sweetness of the earth after a storm has passed. Rudge felt it too, for presently he began to talk. He said he wasn't in the kitchen.
"Not in the kitchen?
Well, then what?
Who?"
"It was she. Only she. She was kicking and struggling from the middle beam, you know. And there was an overturned chair at her feet. She was worse than he. Far worse. Poor devil. So he didn't kill her, you see." Next morning, we headed out with Mrs. James, and we didn't permit her memory to be hazy or defective. She must have known that we had seen something, and presently she spoke openly. She said,
"Well, he said he'd found her hanging in the kitchen, the poor gentleman, and that he'd buried her because he was afraid people would say that he'd done it. But the jury wouldn't believe him, and the doctors all said that it wasn't true, that the marks on her neck was where he'd strangled her with the rope. No, I don't believe it to this day that he did it. I don't."
And that was all we heard and all we wished to hear. Afterwards, Rudge said to me, "You know, for his sake, the truth as we know it ought to be told to everybody. If people knew as we know, it might let him rest. I'm sure that's what he wanted, just that people should know." "Yes, you write it. I can't." And so, I have.
Can turn up the lights now. You can look around you. Nobody is there, really. Everything is all right, isn't it?
Now here is Nelson Olmsted to tell us about next week. Mr. Olmsted?
Next week we have two unusually fine stories. The first is by Catherine Ann Porter and is entitled The Jilting of Granny Weatherall. And the second is The Weird Tale of a Madman by Paul Ernst, called Escapes.
You have been listening to Sleep No More, an NBC Radio Network production directed by Kenneth McGregor. Mr. Olmsted's albums are recorded exclusively for Vanguard Records. Until next week, when Nelson Olmsted will again be here in person, this is Ben Grauer bidding you good night.
traveled on a new hot line. Listen for news on the hour and the exciting hot line service all day, every day, on most of these NBC radio stations.